The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Leffler, and our guest this week is Adam Sherry on the subject of estate planning with trusts and the tax law affecting estates. You know, we're sticking with our tax theme, and we're going to be looking at the strategies you can take to lower taxes. We've discussed this earlier on this series. As we've mentioned, we still have 8 more months to plan, so it's not too late in taking steps to lower taxes for 2015, which will be payable in 2016. We've talked about the ways to reduce investment taxes, and today we're going to be looking at broader tax planning, the techniques that encompass a much broader strategy. We know about tax-free, tax-deferred, and tax-sheltered issues. What else, Jim?
Well, I mean, when you look at tax planning techniques, John, they can be broken down into what we call 5 basic strategies. Number 1 would be tax elimination or reduction. You can do that, as we talked in previous weeks, on deductions above the line. That's the front page of your tax return. Or deductions below the line. These are things like itemized deductions, and incorporate some of the things we've already talked about, turning your income to tax-free or tax deferral, uses of pensions. Number 2 is shifting the tax burden to others. And number 3, allowing wealth to accumulate with no current taxation. You're doing that when you're contributing to a pension plan, but there are other things you can do as well. And number 4, taking your returns as capital gains, something guys like Warren Buffett like to do. And number 5, deferring and eliminating potential gains on appreciated property, a subject we'll be taking up with my guest Adam Sherry as we talk about estate planning techniques. Then there's usually, John, just like anything else, there's probably a number of combinations. Sometimes it takes a combination of techniques to have a meaningful impact in reducing taxes. Just as, for example, in using investments to achieve your lifetime income needs, you're not going to find that one investment. You may have to have a diversified portfolio that includes bonds, stocks, cash, or other investments. It's the same when you get to tax planning as well. Usually one technique is probably not going to do it all.
Well, now, in previous shows, we have talked about strategies to reduce taxable income, and these divide into 2 general areas. Number 1, deductions above the line, which means reducing what is reportable as gross income, and deductions below the line, meaning subtractions from your gross income after it's all been gathered. With Obamacare, taxes are hitting more taxpayers, especially a lot of people who weren't prepared for that. In previous programs, we went over this, and we went over the fact that key levels of income seem to be at breakpoints of $250,000, $300,000, and $454,000 for married people, $200,000, $300,000, and $404,000 for single people. And I think we concluded at that time, Jim, the best strategy are above-the-line deductions. That's a better one. You know, obviously, you take it wherever you can do it, but here, the strategy is better to do above-the-line deductions. So now, before we move on to larger strategies, let's do a refresher of the things that you can do to reduce above-the-line income and mitigate, especially, the impact of Obamacare.
Yeah, that's really a key here because, as we have talked about on previous programs, everybody's aware of the $400,000 and $450,000 when you move into the Obamacare brackets. As we've covered on previous shows, we talked about the key figures of $250,000 when you add the 3.8% Obamacare tax on your investment income, whether it's interest, dividends, capital gains. Also, at that level, you add the additional 0.9% Medicare tax at $300,000. They take 3% of your adjusted gross income and subtract that from your itemized deduction. So you really want to push that number down. And if you're listening to the show, if you look at your tax return, the bottom line on page 1 of your tax return is something called adjusted gross income. That's a key figure that you want to reduce. Now, as we mentioned There are a number of things you can do that. You can trade business expenses, contributions to individual IRAs or retirement accounts, alimony, interest penalty on early withdrawal, moving expenses, health savings accounts. Those are things that bring down your adjusted gross income. And so you want to do as much of that as possible because these are the most effective in reducing overall taxes. And the reason you want to reduce above line going back because number one, it reduces your overall taxable income, which ends up lower taxes. Number two, it keeps the loss of itemized deductions and exemptions as a result of the additional Obamacare taxes. And the trend, John, as we've seen over the years in Washington, is to go after these itemized deductions, which politicians call tax preference items. And this really hurts a lot of middle-class taxpayers. So if you reduce your adjusted gross income, not only are you going to reduce your taxable income, but you're also going to preserve all those itemized deductions that you get for paying state taxes, your interest expense, charitable contributions. So it's a very effective tool, and it's a strategy that you want to pursue first above all others.
All right, well, let's move on to five broad strategies which you outline. We'll begin with the first, which is tax elimination or reduction. I think anybody would like the sound of that one.
Well, tax elimination or reduction is anything that is aimed at producing income tax deductions, exemptions, and credits that reduce your taxable income. Let's begin with the obvious. Everybody knows that if you have tax-free bonds, well, you look at the front page of your tax return, qualified dividends or tax-exempt interest is excluded. Dividends are taxed at a different rate, usually at 15 to 20% or even more if you have the Obamacare tax. So those are some of the obvious ones. And, you know, what you really want to do is get as much of those as possible or reduce as much of your taxable income. Then there's other things that you get either from your employer that are non-taxable. For example, if you work for a company and your medical insurance is paid for by the company as a benefit, well, that's non-taxable. It could become taxable in the future, however, after 2016, if you have a plan known as a Cadillac plan, then some of those benefits are going to become taxable under Obamacare. But that's been postponed until after the 2016 presidential election. But that's going to be a big one, especially if you have a good plan. But your medical coverage could be non-taxable, disability income, things like life insurance or group insurance. These are benefits your employer provides you that are non-taxable to you as the employee. So these are things that are very effective. And then, you know, other techniques is tax loss selling to reduce your capital gains. And especially this hits a lot of individuals, John, that have mutual funds, because mutual funds are required if, let's say, they own stocks in the portfolio that pay dividends or they have capital gains on stocks they've owned in the portfolio, they're required to make those distributions to you on a taxable basis. And usually you get that little surprise in the fourth quarter of the year. You're going along and all of a sudden you get this whopping capital gain distribution, which reduces the value of the shares because they're distributed to you. You can either reinvest, but what you might want to do is towards the end of the year, I mean, this is what we do with our clients. We take a look at the capital gains and then we take a look at, is there anything we can do to offset that to reduce the capital gains so we can eliminate the tax? And if you have some losses, you can use up to $3,000 against your ordinary income. But that's what we call tax elimination or reduction.
Jim, aren't there other ways to reduce capital gains?
Well, there is, depending on the type of assets you own. For example, if you own a home, there are exclusions if you sell your principal residence. For example, you can exclude $250,000 if you're a single individual or $500,000 if you're a married couple. Now, the provision is you must have lived in your principal residence 2 out of the most recent 5 years. And, you know, there's other opportunities that you can do. You can move from one house to another, and you can do it once you, let's say, sell a house. 2 years later, you can move into another house and do the same thing. There's also things with real estate, especially with investment real estate. There's something called a 1031 exchange where you would exchange one piece of property for another. You would still maintain your lower basis in your previous property, but you can avoid the tax on the exchange. And also, you can do the same with annuity. annuities and life insurance contracts, something called a 1035 exchange. So really what you're doing is you're moving into another asset and you're excluding the taxation. And then, of course, with the principal residence, assuming that you've lived in it for two out of the most recent 5 years, you can exclude either $250,000 in capital gains and $500,000. John, you remember back in the old days when as long as you sold a house and bought a house of equal value, you could keep deferring your gain in each home that you owned. Problem was you had to keep track of your cost basis, you know, the things you did to fix up the house. So in the 90s, they did away with that and just said, look, we're just going to give you a $250,000 exemption or exclusion and $500,000. But those are other ways that you can reduce capital gains. And we'll talk about another one that's involved with the estate planning.
All right, let's move on to the second strategy, which is shifting the tax burden to others. I mean, I'm assuming here that I'm not saying, Jim, you pay my taxes this year, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, good. Well, let me get you the paperwork. Hold on. Wait a minute. I got to send you the paperwork. Yeah. How does this work?
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll pay your taxes if you pay mine.
I'll do that. It'll be the biggest rubber okay. check in the history of the IRS. No, in all seriousness, what does it mean?
You know, under this technique, we're talking about shifting the burden or the tax burden to others. Now, this is really mainly done between family members. A typical scenario would be gifts that parents make to their own children or to their grandchildren. For example, let's say that I bought a stock and I paid $10 a share. And that stock now is worth $20 or $30 a share. So I could go through a gifting program. I could give $14,000 of stock to my children or a grandchild. I wouldn't pay any gift tax. And what I'm doing is I'm shifting that stock now, which is, let's say, producing income, maybe has, you know, large capital gains. I'm shifting it to somebody else, my children or my grandchildren. Now, the problem is they do inherit the basis. So if I bought it for $10, they go to sell it at $30. They're going to pay the capital gains, but they may be in a lower tax bracket. And by the way, and we're going to be covering this next month when we get to education, it's a very effective tool for a lot of you parents or grandparents out there that are wanting to help your grandchildren. You can make a gift of $14,000 to a grandchild and have the parents put that in a 529 plan, and that will compound and become tax-free if used for college education. So we'll be covering a lot of that next month as we cover education. But essentially what you're doing in this technique, John, is you're transferring assets to somebody else, and it's normally within the family with kids and grandkids.
So here we've covered two strategies. Number one, tax reduction or elimination. Number two, shifting the tax burden to others through a process of gifting. Now, let's move on to wealth accumulation without taxation. Now, this one sounds interesting too.
Well, this is a very powerful one and can take on many forms. Let's begin with some of the obvious ones. If you put money in an IRA, you're not only going to get a tax deduction, same thing if you're putting money in a 401k. So any kind of pension in any form, SEP IRAs, IRAs, 401k, profit sharing plans, defined benefit plans, and it also does something that's very effective, as we talked about. It's going to reduce your top line income, deductions above the line that we talked about is so effective. It not only reduces your income taxes, but more importantly, any dividends, interest, or capital gains are not taxed. They're tax deferred. And I want to clarify something. When we're talking about tax planning techniques or reducing taxable income on the investment side, we got an email last week and somebody mentioned something about, well, you can go into an S&P index fund, which has a low turnover. And, you know, that is absolutely true. If you're in a low tax bracket, it makes a lot of sense. But what we're talking about here is techniques where somebody's probably in a maybe 28 to 30% federal bracket. Here in California, you're in a 9.3 for just about everybody. You're talking about a 40% tax on income, which can be significant. So this is what we're talking about here. Now, there's several ways to do this. The obvious one, as we just talked about, is pension plans. Another one is tax-deferred annuities or deferred comp programs. If you're working at a company that offers such benefits, a lot of companies, especially the big Fortune 500 companies, for their highly compensated execs, will probably end up doing something like that, especially when they get big compensation programs where they get big bonuses. So a tax-deferred annuity, a deferred comp program, tax-free buildup of life insurance policies. Another one that can maybe reduce income over time or stretch out the tax is installment sales on a property or business. The only thing that you have to worry about, especially with C-Corps, and we're going to get into this with the case study this week, is the accumulated earnings tax. But basically what you're trying to do is reduce your taxable income in the form of either tax deferral in some form or another, pension, annuities, deferred comp, life insurance, installment sales. You're basically pushing it out. And by the way, Warren Buffett does this. I think Berkshire Hathaway has $58 billion of deferred tax. So obviously, if I owe money to the government and I can defer paying that tax, I still have that money in my hands that I can still earn income. And this can be so effective because, I mean, everybody knows Warren Buffett is, what, the second richest man in the world, and he's a very shrewd investor. Everybody knows that about Buffett. But what they don't know, he's a very, very shrewd businessman, especially when it comes to income taxes. He allows a lot of his income to accumulate inside Berkshire Hathaway, where he owns 20% of the company. And so he has a C Corp. He can also invest in companies like Coca-Cola, American Express. And in a C corporation, you can exclude 70% of the dividends you receive inside your C corporation from income taxation. So not only is he deferring tax, but he's also not paying tax on the dividends he receives from his investments, whether it's, you know, American Express or it's Coca-Cola or some of the large holdings that Buffett has. And it's not completely excluded from tax. You know, Berkshire still pays income tax on 30% of the dividends they receive. But let's put it this way. How many of you would like to exclude 70% of your dividends from taxation? And this is why he's not only one of the, what, the second richest man, he's not only a shrewd investor, but he's also a shrewd tax planner.
Now, the other technique you mentioned is long-term capital gains, which are taxed at much more favorable rates, say 15 to 20% versus 39.6% for tax. We said the same thing with dividends. We've talked about that several shows ago. Dividends and capital gains are taxed at lower rates. And this one seems pretty straightforward as long as you can set it up properly.
Well, I mean, it's really something that's really not clearly understood by investors. And I'm always amazed that investors aren't aware that their interest income could be taxed at the highest tax rates of 39.6, and it really could be up to 45% depending on where your income bracket is. And even more so today with Obamacare, because you look at dividends today. First of all, they have a higher yield than what you can get in the bond market. We're talking about an era where we're not only talking about low interest rates, we're talking about negative interest rates. And, you know, you take a look at the yield, it's better on stocks than it is on bonds. Greater wealth accumulation, that's how you get guys like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And investors are under this illusion, John, they can't lose money in bonds. And 2013 should be a wake-up call to any investor, because that year, if you were in bond funds, you lost high single to low double digits. And remember, the Fed now is going to be embarking on raising interest rates over the next couple of years. That's not going to be good news. You can lose money in bonds. So you're getting a lower yield. You're paying more on the tax side, which is why you see Warren Buffett has been mainly a stock investor. Higher returns, greater appreciation and accumulation, and lower taxation.
So what are the other issues related to capital gains we might not have mentioned so far?
Well, there are tax avoidance issues related to gains that can be accomplished in several ways. And one that makes sense, or I'm going to be talking about with my guest, Adam Sherry, coming up here in a moment, is through estate planning techniques. There's something called a stepped-up basis in cost. And what that is let's say that, I don't know, you're an executive at a corporation and you had stock options and, you know, let's say your basis in a stock is $100,000 and the value of that stock is $1 million. When one spouse passes away, the value of that stock gets stepped up to market value. So if it was $1 million value at date of death, that is the new value to the survivor or to the heirs. So you can eliminate essentially capital gains at death through estate planning. Another one that we've used effectively, especially with, you know, sale of business or highly appreciated assets, is through a charitable remainder trust. You can get a tax deduction for putting money into the charitable trust. You get that deduction up front. You can use it to offset your income in that year. And then also you could then sell the asset, don't pay any capital gains. And the big savings that you would have are twofold. One, you avoid the capital gains. And then number two, you get the tax deduction for making the gift to the charitable trust. So this is a very effective way for highly appreciated assets, whether it comes to real estate or it comes to gains, sale of a business. You know, we had a case study where an individual had a C corporation, and you'll see it in a case study today, where he was bought out by a public company. We used that stock, transferred to a charitable trust, got a huge tax deduction, which we used over a 3 or 4 year period to reduce his taxable income, sold the stock, which hardly paid anything, and avoided all that capital gain here in the California. It would have been, at that time, the capital gains rate was 20%, and the state of California tax was 9.3. So we saved almost 30% in capital gains right off the bat, not to mention the tax deduction. So this is another way. Something that we also do sometimes with executives who get, let's say, stock options, is we use sort of equity collars to sort of protect the value of the stock, where we might write puts to protect the downside, especially if it's a major asset, and then write calls to take the call premium to pay for the put premium. And we basically collar that stock and protect it against, without actually selling the stock, so that a major asset, the executive doesn't have to worry about, you know, what happens if we go through a bear market, lose 40% of the value of that stock in a bear market. So that's another technique.
So for summarizing here, there are five key tax reduction strategies. Number one, it's tax elimination or reduction. Two, shifting the tax burden to others. Three, allowing wealth to accumulate without current taxation. Four, taking returns as capital gains. And five, deferring or eliminating potential capital gains. Now, it should be pointed out you can use these in combination, but you should understand that your options here, taxes saved or deferred, builds a larger retirement nest egg, because that's more money you have now that you can pour towards earnings for the future for your retirement. Time to put all of this together. As we always do here on the program, we have a real life case study. The case study is a real life case study. That's why we call it a real life case study. But the names have been changed to protect the privacy of the individuals involved. So who are our two fictitious but real people this week, Jim?
John and Carol Loeffler.
No, we're real and non-fictitious. Although if I could get royalties on the fiction, I'd take it.
Okay. Now, this week, we're going to talk about a couple, Chuck and Debbie Easton. Chuck was the main principal in a software company. The problem with Chuck is high taxable income. He was in the high six figures when he came to see us, and it was likely moving to seven figures, which is where he is now. His company had about 15 employees. The problem was Chuck was in that Obamacare tax bracket, close to 45% on the federal level and 12% in the state of California. You add those two together, you're talking about 57%. And the company was growing at a rate of almost 20% a year. And it was his belief, longer term, not only would the company grow, but eventually, since some venture capitalists were already talking to him and his other partners, that, you know, investing some seed money in the company, and eventually maybe the company got taken out. So, you know, eventually Chuck's income was moving towards seven figures, which is where he is now.
Well, it sounds like an interesting problem to have, but the negative here, as I see it, is a heavy tax burden. 57% would seem to almost destroy whatever incentives there might be. So how did you resolve this particular issue?
You know, this one was a number of issues that we had to take place. Number one, we incorporated his business into a C corporation. There were a number of reasons for doing that. Number one, liability protection, especially against his personal assets. Two was the lower tax rate. So you take a look at corporate tax rates and you compare those to individual tax rates. And this really comes into play with the Obamacare taxes, because We move not only beyond 39.6% on the tax brackets, but in a C corp, the first $50,000 of income are taxed at 15%, the next $25,000 at 25%, and ultimately between $335,000 and $10 million, you're in a 34% tax rate versus a 44% federal. So, and more importantly, given the fact of the growth of the company, if you're taken over more likely by a public company, one of the most effective tax deferral strategies would be is exchanging your C corporation stock for the company that's taken you over. Let's assume a public company. That way, you could do a number of things. In this case, Chuck is a California resident. And let's say, I don't know, down the road, he sells his company for 20, 30, 40 million. I don't know, whatever it's going to be. It's probably, in the case of the revenues of Chuck's company, it's probably going to be over 100 million at the rate that they're growing. So let's say Chuck walks away with, you know, 20, 30, 40 million dollars of stock of a public company that bought him. There's two things he can do. Number one, on the buyout, there is no tax. He just gets shares in the new company. Number two, Chuck could then decide to move to another state like Florida or Texas. Kind of the same thing that you see with athletes like Tiger Woods. When he went pro and got endorsements, he moved from California to Florida. So that way you can eliminate the 12.3% tax rate. So there are a number of things that was ideal. So we set up the C Corp. The second thing that we did is the company also, as they were growing to make it more attractive to attract employees, we set up a 401k program. The growth of the company and the number of employees made it ineffective to use more, let's say, deferral enhancing pension plan techniques. It doesn't work when you have a large employee base. We set up a 401k, put his wife on the payroll for about $28,000 a year. That allowed his wife to put in $23,000 in a 401k program for herself. And same with Chuck. And also, the corporation could invest unused cash that wasn't using to grow the business into dividend paying stocks and exclude 70% of those dividends from federal taxation. And then the other thing that is on the books is setting up some kind of deferred comp program with the key principles in the program, especially if the company continues to grow at its present pace. And then the other thing, to protect him and also because the size of the estate, Chuck's interest in the company was probably worth at this point when he came to see us somewhere in the neighborhood of about $20 million. We set up an ABC trust because of the size of the assets, the value of the company. And then on the personal side, we started setting up a laddered tax-free bond portfolio because it just made a lot of sense being in a 57% tax bracket in the state of California and federal, 12 for the state of California and over 40% for the federal bracket. It made a lot of sense to be in tax-free bonds.
Yeah, and why not stocks?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at where was Chuck's major asset, his major asset, you know, he had a couple million dollars on the personal side plus a home that was free and clear, but the major asset was the business. And so the growth of the business really, I mean, Chuck had a stock. It was called his own company. And so you really want to balance out that risk with something that is less risky. You know, obviously at the growth rate his company was, he owned a growth stock and there was probably less risk there because he was in control with his partners. But on the personal side, it just didn't make sense. And you want to do something a little bit more on the conservative side and balance out the risk that they have with the business, which was one reason that we did the tax-free bonds. And really, with long-term planning, with the business structure, with the C corporation, we really wanted to keep his personal assets non-taxable. We could build up some assets in the corp, either in his 401k program, stocks that the corporation would own. But the growth path that he was on, and especially with the venture capitalists wanting to get involved in the company, is, you know, VCs get involved with companies because they think they have the potential to be sold. That's how they get paid. That's how they make their money. So with VCs getting involved with the company, the idea was down the road, this company was going to be sellable. And so that was really the tax planning strategy with the C corporation and then tidying things up and protecting his assets. So we used a combination of strategies, but this was as a result of the size of the assets and the growth of those assets.
All right. So another successful story.
Yeah. And, you know, that is the goal. And at the rate of growth, it's highly likely, especially now that they're talking to VC people, that the VCs see a software company as a potential takeover target. And if that happens, well, he's got a number of planning options. If he's taken out by a public company, there is no tax on the exchange of shares. And secondly, that gives him the option to move to another state to get rid of California's onerous 12% income tax.
Which a lot of people seem to be doing. People are moving from states with high taxation to states with lower or no taxation to reduce their tax burden. Coming up next, Adam Sherry, discussion, estate planning with trusts and tax law affecting estates as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
For the longest time, we didn't know what the estate tax rates would be. In fact, there was one year, had you passed away, there were no estate taxes at all. Thank you, George Steinbrenner, who timed it perfectly. But since then, we've had tax law changes, and there's a little bit more certainty, which means you may have the wrong kind of estate plan given where we ended up after the tax law changes. Joining me on the program is Adam Sherry. He's a principal at Anderson & Yoakum. Adam, let's talk about the 2012 Tax Act, because that brought a lot of clarification to estate planning, where up until then, there was a lot of uncertainty in terms of what the tax rates were going to be, what the exemption was going to be. And then we had that crazy year when there was no estate taxes, but you might have foregone the step up. So bring us up to date. What changed in 2012, and why is that important for our listeners to understand regarding their own estate plan?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me, Jim. You know, that was really a disconcerting time to be practicing. No one knew what was happening, and you felt real confident saying that to a client because the Congress didn't know what was happening, the president necessarily didn't know what was happening, and confusion and chaos reigned there for a little bit. And then, as you had mentioned, there was the 2012 American Tax Relief Act that really started to crystallize things and to firm it up so that we could get back to planning for our clients. And that was a welcomed law. As you identified, the exemption amount really was in flux prior to that. However, starting with that 2012 law, it set the basic exemption amount at $5 million per person, and it was indexed for inflation. First off, that was a pretty significant jump. As recently as 2003, the exemption amount was only $1 million. And so starting at 2011, we've set the baseline at $5 million, and it's gone up, as I said, indexed for inflation. So that means that if you were to pass away in 2015, the estate tax exemption amount is now $5.4 million due to the indexing for inflation.
Let's talk about the implications for that for estate planning, because Adam, as you are, I'm sure, well aware, for the longest time, the exemption was roughly about $1 million. And so a lot of the trusts that were written by estate planning attorneys were called AB trust. Can you explain the AB trust and how that may no longer be applicable to where we are today?
So the AB trust really was standard issue there for a while. If you were at all close to exceeding the exemption amount, which, as we just discussed, was hovering at a lower rate than it is today. And so in an AB trust, at the point that the first spouse passes away, the assets in the trust are divided into two separate trusts, an A trust and a B trust. The A trust is for the surviving spouse. It's often called the survivor's trust. And the B trust is for the deceased spouse's one half interest in the trust. And that's either referred to as the B trust or the decedent's trust. So while it was definitely a good idea there for a while based on the estate tax exemption amount, it comes along with some real drawbacks.
And let's talk about those drawbacks, because let's just take a couple out right now. Let's just make it simple. Let's just say they have a $2 million estate. Husband passes away. They have an AB trust. I assume $1 million would go into the B trust. And let's talk about the capital gain tax problems that that may create as a result.
You hit it right on the head. That's one of the two main problems with the AB trust. Once that amount is divided from the trust corpus as a whole and segregated into the B trust, it's set at that value. And on the surviving spouse's death, the assets in that B trust are not stepped up to current market value. And if you think about something like if it were to be holding real property or other assets that had appreciated during the surviving spouse's life after the deceased spouse passed away, that really could be a very substantial increase that is no longer eligible for the stepped-up basis on the second spouse's death.
And, you know, this sometimes can be rather significant, especially, Adam, in where you have a situation where, let's say there's an age difference between, let's say, a husband and wife. Let's say the wife is younger. And given the fact that longevity-wise, women tend to outlive men by 4 or 5 years.
Definitely. It's a real issue. Apart from that, one of the other things that you and I have discussed is some of the administrative issues that are associated with the A and B trust. You know, when we say that it's split into two separate trusts, they really are two separate trusts. So they need to be accounted for separately. Let's just say that $1 million, let's say it was all liquid. You would have to actually establish a second bank account in the name of the B trust. And you wouldn't be able to necessarily treat all those assets as if they were one, because you really do need to respect the terms of the trust in order to qualify for some of the benefits that they once offered, which have now kind of turned more into a stumbling block than a benefit.
And this is becoming more significant. For example, when you get to a substantial estates where you could have, let's say, appreciated stock, an executive worked for a corporation where there's a low cost basis, or a situation where you have, let's say, great real estate that's appreciated. Let's talk about the step up for the heirs, too, because that's important. Because let's say mom's a survivor. So you have a house here in California, which makes you a millionaire automatically if you live in California. But let's say there's that $1 million house in California, or there's a property. And if it was placed in the B trust and it appreciated substantially, the tax on real estate from capital gains is higher. You add the Obamacare tax of 3.8% on that, plus the state of California on top of that, which could be as high as 13%. I mean, you're talking about some big numbers here.
It's a very big deal. And especially when we're talking about a couple like you had just described, in which there may be a certain age difference, the appreciation during that period could have really been significant. And sometimes it's possible to plan effectively and avoid these things. And other times it's just something that you have to deal with. But this sort of an issue really hurts, I suppose, because it can be avoided. If that real property were held by the surviving spouse until the point that she passed away, as we were talking about a step up in basis, just to kind of lay it out very plainly, the value of the real property would be increased to the current market value as of the date of death of the surviving spouse. So if mom and dad were to own this home and then mom were to own it after dad passed away, it stepped up all the way to the current market value, regardless of what their original purchase price was. And so you kind of mentioned the California real estate market, and that's just a great example, because depending on where you live and when you bought, if this was the family home, you could be seeing a value that's the current market value is a multiple of the original purchase price. So if the children, after mom were to pass away, needed to sell the home because they wanted to split the value of it, that's all tax-free as far as the stepped-up basis is concerned. They won't be taxed as far as the gain for the difference between the initial purchase price and the market value as of the date of mom's death.
And I want to talk about something else. We mentioned that not only can you be triggering unneeded capital gains on the death of the second spouse for the heirs, but the other issue that you may have done is you take a husband and wife when they're both alive, they're trustees of their own trust, they have one set of books, one checking account. All of a sudden now you split the trust in two. Now you have two sets of books and there's complications. Let's talk about some of those.
Yeah, they really are complications. And I suppose to really get a full understanding of it, we need to kind of think of who this is going to be affecting and when. For instance, I have a client and her husband just passed away. They had a great life together. They had both saved a lot of money, but unfortunately, they hadn't revisited the form of their trust since it was created well over 15 to 20 years ago. And she lives in an assisted care facility. It's a great facility. She has a lot of friends there. But the truth is, she doesn't want to have to pay attention to two different sets of account. She's kind of set in her own ways when it comes to you know, I pay my bills with this checkbook. You know, I pay for groceries or whatever I need with this bank account. And so I had to sit there and have a discussion with her in which I explained that due to the form of the trust, she was going to have to relearn how she dealt with many of her finances on a very basic level. That was a tough conversation to have. That was a direct result of some of the administrative drawbacks of an AB trust.
Now, let's talk about where it really is appropriate to have an AB trust, because the exemption is, what, $5,450,000 or $430,000. So really, a husband and wife can pass $10.9 million estate tax-free, but over that amount, you're going to be talking about 40%. So we know right now, Adam, that a flex trust can handle up to, with both exemptions, $10.9 million. But let's talk about an estate that goes beyond that, where you might have a $20 million estate or a $30 million estate. Let's talk about something a little bit more complex, which is the ABC trust and the role that that plays and how that protects heirs and surviving spouse.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would hate to give the impression based on our conversation up to this point that any sort of trust that starts with AB, anything, is a bad idea, because, you know, there's plenty of circumstances in which something that resembles an AB trust is entirely appropriate. And that's kind of like the family structure that you're discussing right now. So in the case where the couple's estate exceeds the combined estate tax exemption, like you had just mentioned, at a $10.9 million were they to pass away this year, then we would recommend something like an ABC trust. And so an ABC trust gives you the best of both worlds. It allows you to shelter as much as possible using each individual's estate tax exemption. But then also, if you were to exceed that, like this couple that may have a combined net worth of $20 million, then you're able to create a third trust that catches the overflow, which is the C trust. So in a situation like that, on the death of the first spouse, that spouse's full exemption amount would go to fund the B trust. The surviving spouse's share of the estate would stay in the A trust, or the survivor's trust, and then anything over that amount would go into the C trust. And so in a situation with an estate like this, some of the benefits of an ABC trust can be illustrated by the fact that the C trust and the B trust are both available during the surviving spouse's lifetime, oftentimes to pay for his or her needs as far as health, education, maintenance, and support. However, they also have the option not to take any money from the B trust and live off the survivor's trust and the C trust. And that enables the assets in the B trust to appreciate in value. However, the benefit here is that so long as they were not funded in excess of the exemption amount, which would be the $5.4 million, even if it were to increase in value, the additional value is not taxed upon the death of the surviving spouse.
And there's a strategy also along that lines that can be combined with investment planning. So let's say that you put together a growth stock portfolio, or let's say a blue chip portfolio, the kind of stocks you'd find in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, of growing that wealth, not touching it, and allowing that wealth, whatever is in that B trust, escapes taxation on the death of the second spouse.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's a really exciting moment for a family when they're able to realize that all the growth in that B trust, it really is all estate tax free because the full exemption amount was used, which is good. So that means there's no tax on the assets that initially funded the B trust. And then as you just pointed out, everything that increases in value beyond that point is free of estate tax. And similarly, a plan can be used wherein you know that the assets in the C trust are going to be subject to estate tax at the point that the surviving spouse passes away. So when it comes to kind of prioritizing a family budget, assets can be taken first from the C trust when it comes to expenditures for basics like health, education, maintenance, and support. And you can kind of hold off on the other assets in the B trust and the A trust so that you don't disadvantage yourself when it comes to estate tax planning.
Yeah, because we have a case right now where as a result of setting up that ABC trust and doing just that with the surviving spouse living off the C and the A trust, eventually we're going to pass over $20 million that will be estate tax free to the heirs. And so this can become rather significant, especially combined with the right investment strategy. I want to move on to another topic because this relates to a lot of our listeners out there where you have a lot of boomers that, unlike maybe their parents, didn't go to work for a company for 30 years, retired with the Timex watch and a pension. So they had maybe a couple employers, and basically what they have is this 401k program, and they transferred over into an IRA rollover. A lot of times you name your spouse as a survivor, but a lot of times in the case of trust, they name the trust as the secondary beneficiary. Adam, let's talk about the problems of income taxes in doing that.
I'd be happy to, because this really is an issue, kind of like the AB trust that we discussed earlier, where a little bit of planning can go a long way. So as you identified, if a spouse were to name their own spouse as the first beneficiary of their retirement account, there's certain advantages that they can avail themselves of, you know, due to the fact that it's passing to their surviving spouse. However, those same options aren't available to the surviving spouse when it comes to passing them on to the family. So oftentimes what they'll do is name the trust as the alternate beneficiary because, you know, that's the part of their planning that lays out who they want their assets to go to and how. And the whole name of the game when it comes to retirement accounts is deferring tax. And so the absence of a single clause in the trust can really just kind of eliminate that whole benefit. And that's what you refer to as the stretch out. And so the stretch out provision in a trust states that the minimum required distribution from the retirement account must be taken as often as it's required according to the terms of that account. And by doing so, they're able to stretch out the benefits from the retirement plan. So the stretch out provision is just essential in the trust. When the stretch out provision isn't there, then the deferred gains are going to be limited to 5 years, as in the entire balance of the retirement account must be distributed within 5 years, which, you know, is really missing out on some real benefits. When the stretch out provision is present in the trust, the trustee is able to take the age of the oldest beneficiary and apply that to the retirement plan for stretch out purposes, which enables you to continue to defer tax on that appreciation, you know, I mean, 15, 10, 25 years, depending on the age of the beneficiaries of the trust.
And that can be substantial in terms of building up a net worth for your heirs in terms of a substantial asset that is allowed to grow and grow even further, which could actually be almost the equivalent of having another pension for an individual. And let's talk about, if you don't have those provisions, what happens when the trust is there? Then what happens is all of a sudden you've got an income tax problem, not only federal taxes, which means you could be put into the Obamacare tax brackets. And then also here, unfortunately, for the state of California, where we have the highest income tax rates, you could have the combination of federal and state taxes take over 50% of an IRA, which could be rather substantial.
Absolutely. I mean, you hit it right on the head. And it's just so unfortunate from a planning perspective, because in order to get these benefits of the stretch out, it doesn't require a complex plan or a lot of work between you and your estate planner or your investment advisor. It requires a single paragraph be added to your trust. And really, it's that simple.
And I would think that more and more advisors or individuals would be aware of this, but it's unfortunate that this is not really clearly understood by a lot of the investment public.
You know, it's really not. And I really don't think that they can be blamed for that. The rules associated with retirement accounts, as you know, are very complex. And then once you start looking at them in the context of different types of trust, the interaction there can get really complex very fast. And that's why I suppose it's surprising that there's such a simple fix. But you're entirely correct that when those two different sets of rules or laws start interacting, it creates a situation in which this can easily be overlooked by an estate planner, an investment advisor, somebody who hasn't already kind of seen the problems associated with this or just taken the time to really look into the interplay of the different laws.
I want to move on to something else, that one of the big mistakes that we see in so many estate planning, where individuals haven't gone to a qualified attorney and have gotten a estate plan, and they think, okay, a lot of times you'll see this with a surviving spouse, a wife, let's say the wife unintentionally says, well, you know what, I'll just retitle my house and join tenancy with my kids. Let's talk about some of the problems.
Yeah, there really are some problems there. And so I face that oftentimes when you're speaking with a client and they are hesitant to engage in a certain amount of planning, and they're trying to think of quick fixes or an end run around this sort of a problem. And so they think, I trust my children. I'm just going to name it in joint tenancy, and then it'll pass directly to them and avoid probate. And that's true. It will avoid probate, which is a major benefit as far as the owner of the home is concerned. But it's an issue where you aren't able to benefit from the step up. And so by naming your children joint tenants on your home, they become part owners at that point. And so at the point that the initial owner, the parent, passes away, it's not considered a transfer occurring at that point. The child's already a part owner. And since they're already a part owner, they don't benefit from the step up that is associated if the parent were to hold on to it during their lifetime and then pass it to their children through a probate avoidance trust or some other trust. And as we've discussed before, the implications of that can be very serious from a financial perspective.
Let's talk about also some things that may even bring in a situation that's even worse. Is, let's say the children are put on the home as joint tenants with mom. One of the children get into a car accident, a serious one, and they get sued.
Thank you. That's a great point. I mean, because oftentimes we'll be talking with clients and they have a great relationship with their children and they really can trust them in that sort of a position. However, as you just identified, they're not able to account for everything else that's going on in the wider world. And so by putting a child as a partial owner, that also means that that asset is subject to claims by their creditors. So, I mean, God forbid there's a very serious accident and it results in a judgment against that child who you named as a joint tenant. You know, you just ended up in a situation where, in an attempt to avoid probate, in an attempt to avoid engaging in a certain amount of planning, your home that you've lived in, spent an awful long time paying off, is now subject to the claims of the creditors that entered into your life through this accident that really nobody could have foreseen.
So instead of that, let's just talk about a simple trust, not even a disclaimer, where let's say there's not enough assets or maybe it's not very complex. What are the means or alternatives to, let's say, naming children in joint tenancy? Obviously, I would suspect it's going to be some form of a trust.
Absolutely. And, you know, the type of trust is a probate avoidance trust. And so your preface to the question was an excellent one, because when people start using the trust word, oftentimes a person associates that with estates of pretty large size. Like they start thinking about something fancy or a taxable estate or something like that. But any estate that is over $150,000, or that owns real property over $25,000, and this is in California. However, oftentimes there's similar laws in other states. Your assets will be subject to probate in order to transfer them from you to the persons who you'd like them to go to. And one of the interesting things that often comes up is that people think that they've dealt with this problem by executing a will. So a will is a great instrument in that you're able to identify who you'd like your assets to go to. However, it's still going to be subject to probate before those assets can be transferred to the persons you identified.
So when you take a look at this, we talked about some of the situations that have come about as a result of the tax law changes, and thank goodness they've been favorable. There's some clarity there. The tax rates, we know what they are. They're lower. The exemption is much higher, and it's indexed to inflation. So when we talk about that and we talk about these other assets, let's talk about one final case, and that is when you really start to get into the upper stratosphere when it comes to wealth. I'm talking people 30, 40, 50 million, where now you're talking about things like charitable remainder trust, you're talking about foundations. What are some of those avenues there?
You've named two excellent ones. So a charitable remainder trust is a way in which you can identify a certain portion of your estate, a portion that's likely to be subject to estate tax, and a person may have a charitable intent or, you know, a particular church or a group that they've worked with. Maybe it's their local synagogue that they've been part of, or they really like the Boy Scouts or something like that. And they're able to say, you know, as part of my legacy, I'd like to leave a certain amount of my estate to them. You know, however, I'm leaving behind children or grandchildren, and I'd also like them to benefit. So by using a charitable remainder trust, they're able to designate a person to receive a certain portion of their estate, and the remainder, after that portion of their estate is distributed to the person they identify, ultimately goes to the charitable organization that they've identified. And the value of that portion that's ultimately distributed to the charitable organization is exempt from estate tax because it's going to a purpose that will benefit the larger community.
Well, listen, Adam, we've covered quite a few subjects right here, and I'm sure we could spend probably another hour talking about some of the more finer complexities of it. If our listeners would like to find out more about the work you do, how can they do so, please?
The website for my firm is AndersonYocum.com. That's AndersonYocum.com, or I can be reached by email at asherry@AndersonYocum.com.
All right, Adam, listen, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Please come back and visit us again.
Sounds great. Thanks, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income program. And folks, please, after listening to that, if you had an estate or a trust that was put together before 2012, and maybe you have an AB trust and you're not in that situation where you're over $10 million, please don't put yourself through the headaches and all the encumbrances that you may have to deal when you don't have to deal with that. There's, as Adam talked about, the disclaimer trust allows that flexibility just in case your net worth increases or Congress lowers the exemption or increases the tax laws. And for goodness sakes, if you have a significant amount of money in an IRA rollover, please check it to make sure it's not going to be subject to the Obama tax rates or high state tax rates when you pass on, so that you can pass it on to your heirs, your children, and defer the taxes and build an estate for them as well. Well, that concludes this week's program. So on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.